Welcome to another special in our continuing Talk Nation Radio series on the nuclear crisis in Japan. I'm Dori Smith, and we're going to be taking a look at the consequences of the nuclear core now being exposed. We're joined again by Michael Marriott. He's executive director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service in the U.S., and he's in touch with colleagues in Japan and other parts of the world as they together look at the risks posed by the meltdown at the Japanese nuclear plants. And you can go to the website NIRS.org, for updates and information, including a map provided by NOAA showing the direction of a plume. Now, this radioactive plume could affect other countries.
Yes, there seems little doubt at this point that there will be some sort of radioactive plume coming toward North America.
Michael Marriott now calling on the U.S. to do a better job of making announcements about any potential needs that American residents might have for potassium iodine. Finally, on Tuesday morning, March 15th, radiation was detected in Tokyo. It was not a high level, but not long after that information was made public, news of yet another magnitude 6 earthquake near Tokyo and surrounding cities. No reports yet of casualties or damage, but we're reading that they were at least magnitude 6. Meanwhile, at the Fukushima plant in Japan, contamination, fire, and radioactive releases. Michael Marriott, it's been a challenging night for people like you who monitor, you know, the kind of activity that we're seeing at these plants. We saw 4 plants in trouble on BBC reports, and then they had an industry representative who, you know, kind of put 4 styrofoam cups out on the table and talked about radioactive levels at each of these 4 cups. It was kind of, let's say, less than satisfactory for those of us wondering what is going on. Can you just fill us in on what you know?
Gosh, I'm sorry I missed that demonstration. There are, I guess I would use the word crises at 4 of the reactors at Fukushima Daiichi right now. There have been explosions at 3 of them. One of the explosions at Unit 2 may have damaged the primary containment. There was a fire. We don't know what the duration of it was in the fuel pool at Unit 4. Late last night, Eastern time, Eastern U.S. time, we're told that the fire has been put out for now, but that's obviously a serious event. Radiation levels were much higher this morning in Japanese time. Japan is 13 hours ahead of us here on the U.S. East Coast. Levels were measured as high as 4 rems per hour on site near Unit 3 and as high as 1 rem per hour at the plant gate to the overall complex. Those are extremely high levels. To try to put it in context, the average background radiation that somebody in the United States receives is 350 millirems per year, not per hour. So it's extremely high levels. The one good sign is that the radiation levels at the plant gate did go down over the course of the day. Those higher measurements were taken at 9:30 in the morning, Japan time. As of about 3 in the afternoon, they had gone down quite a bit, but still at around 50 millirems per hour, which is, again, you know, obviously very, very high. So the situation remains very serious. The most disturbing sign to us that the situation is not really getting any better, despite those better readings, is that only 50 plant workers remain at the site. Tokyo Electric Power evacuated 750 workers. There's only 50 left, and those 50 people, who can only be described as heroic, they have been left to try to deal with problems at 4 nuclear reactors and 4 related fuel pools. And obviously 50 people is not enough to do that. To us, it's a sign that Tokyo Electric may be giving up on this.
In terms of what you're hearing about that critical plant 3 that had the high levels of plutonium that were really a major risk, can you say at this point, is that the one that's had core involvement?
We believe that there has been core melt, at least some core melting at units 1, 2, and 3. We do not know if there has been breaches of the primary containment at any of those reactors. The reactor that is most likely to have breached the containment is, to our understanding, Unit 2, which is the explosion that occurred at Unit 2 last night, Eastern U.S. time. It was a different kind of explosion than the two earlier ones, and is believed that it may have affected that primary containment.
And if that is the case, that the containment is affected at that one plant, how close are the others to it? And I would imagine a lot of heat is generated from a blast and a meltdown. Are we looking at multiple meltdowns that are, let me just put this bluntly, the worst case scenario, do you think?
We're getting uncomfortably close to that. We don't believe that that has happened yet, but there are a few positive signs that the situation is improving or is going to improve. They do not have the ability to cool these reactors at this point. They do not have the ability to cool the fuel pools at this point. The, you know, taking out most of the workforce is a sign that they, it's certainly not a positive sign. We could be looking at a meltdown of 4 nuclear reactors and 4 fuel pools.
And this coming...
Actually, I should add, because there is still no off-site electric power, because the grid is still down, we still have 2 more reactors at the Daiichi site and 4 reactors at the Daini site that are operating with emergency diesel generators. There already have been cooling problems with 3 of the 4 reactors at the Daini site. Unless power can be restored to run these cooling systems, these emergency diesel generators are not designed to operate for long periods of time. And we can expect, if this situation continues for, you know, very many days, that some of these emergency diesel generators are going to conk out and exacerbate the situation.
You said there were still some workers. Are they still pouring seawater on the plants?
I can only make an assumption that they are doing that. I don't know that for a fact.
I know that was a really desperate measure. There are things in seawater, though, that it would seem could be corrosive to these plants, and I wondered about that. You know, plus what difference it makes now that they're introducing that and then dumping it back out. I mean, I think regionally we're seeing more earthquakes, even as I'm speaking with you, a 6 being reported out of an area near Tokyo. And so unconfirmed reports yet about anything that's happened as a result of that. But that's a serious level of earthquake activity still going on. So we've got, what, roughly 50 nuclear plants in Japan total, and we've got what seems to be a continuing instability.
This disaster would stretch any nation's capabilities to the maximum, and that's clearly certainly happening in Japan. We can only hope for the best. I don't know really how much more one country should be expected to take.
I know people from as far away as California are watching this news with concerns for their personal safety now. They're worried about airborne radioactive materials. We've heard that there could be a risk that some of the iodine radioactive that would be coming from the plant exposure here, which we know now to have taken place, will have stuff like cesium bound to it.
Yes, there seems little doubt at this point that there will be some sort of radioactive plume coming toward North America. We have just posted on our website potential trajectories that have been mapped by NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, that were provided by the Weather Underground website. We don't know yet how strong these radioactive plumes will be. At this point, I don't think there's reason to panic, but there may be some protective action recommendations over the next couple of days. To put it in context, for example, after the Chernobyl accident, there actually was some milk interdicted in Oregon because of iodine. Cows tend to concentrate iodine into their milk, and so it was felt that it was better to keep that milk out of the supply. It may be that there will need to be measures like that taken in this event. And if there are other types of measures that need to be taken, for example, if the plume is large enough, it may be that people will want to stay inside for a day or something. But I don't think anybody's at the point where they can make recommendations like that at this time.
And we talked last time, Michael Marriott, about the use of something like a potassium iodine. I know for children, they're very vulnerable, and so are the various kinds of glands, especially the thyroid, that would be involved in uptake of iodine. So we talked about this, and you mentioned distribution problems. I can confirm for you that I've checked with just about every major supply company anyway, most of them out, the ones that do have supply left, like ThyroSafe, they have the liquid versions. They have the child dose, which is the lower dose. An adult would have to take two of those, and that's about it. And I can tell you that they're saying that they're making more supply expected maybe April.
Yeah, April might not be soon enough. There are large stockpiles around nuclear power plants in the United States. And one thing that I think needs to be looked at now, I don't think a decision needs to be made this hour or anything, but I think that one thing that needs to be looked at is whether some of the supplies, are those supplies in the right places for right now.
Now, that is coming from someone who knows this field very well, and you've been putting up alerts for people just for these kinds of reasons. And so you have reached the point now where you're saying that that might be possible. How does that work? I mean, who makes the decision? And, we've heard that various people now have been appointed to monitor this, but they're in the field of watching for security and doing anti-terror work. Brennan, I mean, we don't know yet who's in charge and what they would come up with and when.
That's actually a very good question. And it's sort of a combination of Nuclear Regulatory Commission, FEMA, and the local utilities. And I honestly don't know, who precisely has control of all these local supplies around the country. This issue's been controversial for quite a while now. Congress, if I'm remembering correctly, Congress did pass legislation requiring this potassium iodide stockpiles, but the industry was very reluctant to implement that. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, as well, has often been reluctant to require implementation of that. So I can't tell you right now for a fact that they actually are stockpiled around every site. I think they are, but I'm not positive. It's something I need to look into. I know Representative Ed Markey of Massachusetts put out a statement about this yesterday, but I actually only know that he put it out. I don't know what it said. So I think it's something that's going to have to be looked at very closely over the next day or two.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. We're tracking events in Japan, and we're speaking with Michael Marriott. He's the executive director at the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, NIRS, NIRS.org. As of early Wednesday in Japan, we're getting a report now of another fire at number 4 reactor at Fukushima nuclear plant. There has also been a spike in radioactivity at the plant. It seems as if we're in a race against time here, too, when it comes to the potassium iodine, especially in America. I mean, the doses aren't there, but also, people need advanced information about how to take it, how much to give kids and what the safety precautions are and all of that.
Well, sure. I mean, if the doses aren't there, it's best taken in advance of the exposure. It can be taken sort of immediately after the exposure. In Poland in 1986, after the Chernobyl accident, potassium iodide was very widely distributed. And of course, the Polish didn't know about the accident until after it happened. So clearly, you know, so many exposures already had happened. And that is widely credited for being the reason why Poland has experienced far, far fewer thyroid cancers than its neighbors in Ukraine and Belarus and Russia.
If someone is in some part of the United States, you know, the heartland, the Midwest, as far to the east as maybe Boston, should they consider trying to obtain this? At what level would you say, and where can they find out, time-wise, when it's appropriate to take it?
For the latter part, I would consult a physician or at least a pharmacist. Yeah, I'm certainly not an expert in, you know, the medical aspects. In terms of the when some sort of dose might be expected, I don't think it's imminent. It does take some time for the weather to arrive here. And like I said, we've just put up a NOAA projection on our site, and I'll look very quickly to see if when this might arrive. But so I think we're looking toward the probably weekend, early next week, when we would expect to see any major plume, if in fact there is a major plume even there right now. We don't know that. We don't know the fact that they're receiving high readings at the site boundary at Fukushima does not necessarily mean that there are high levels going into the atmosphere at this time. We just don't know that.
Part of what you're saying, unfortunately, sadly, is that the stuff that's melting at the core level at Reactor 2 could be going more down than up?
Well, it could be depositing close to the site. It could be going into the air. I actually had some conversations this morning with a nuclear engineer who has studied dispersion of radionuclides very carefully, and especially the lessons that we learned from the Three Mile Island accident. And, you know, his takeaway was that you can be standing in one place and 1,000 yards away, somebody standing in a slightly different geographical setup could receive 1,000 times the dose you do. It goes down to that kind of micro level. So it's, you know, this is not an easy science. It's not an easy projection to make. And that's why I'm being a little bit reluctant here. I don't want to advise people to take drugs that are unnecessary or, you know, based on, you know, incomplete information. And we certainly right now have incomplete information.
Well, let's talk about that. And by the way, who was the engineer that you were speaking with?
He's a consultant we work with frequently up in Vermont, Arnie Gunderson.
I see. Thank you. And what we can know for sure, though, is something that, you know, we've heard from various groups and people that we've interviewed, which is the complaint that the Japanese government and officials in the nuclear industry and security there have just not been informing people in a timely and complete way. And so the thought is that that's adding to the panic. What can you tell us finally that we can take away, that we can understand for where we are now and what we're still facing?
I think in terms of, you know, impact on the U.S., you know, radiological impact, it's just too early to, you know, really say. But it is something we're obviously going to be monitoring, you know, very closely over the next couple of days. The impact on Japan, I think we are now at a point where we can say there is going to be at least some small region of Japan that will be uninhabitable for centuries, which is the area around the power plant. Whether it gets worse than that or not, we just don't know. This is still unfolding. If somehow they got power back an hour from now, we could be sitting here next week saying, you know, crisis averted. On the other hand, you know, all signs are that things are continuing to deteriorate.
Can you just go over some of the reasons that it would be impossible or challenging to bring in an alternative energy source like a solar unit or some kind of power unit now to back up what they had? I mean, is it just too much of a demand that they couldn't get enough of a resource in there quickly enough, or what's the problem?
Well, the reactors rely on emergency diesel generators to produce their power. These are, you know, very large pieces of machinery. They're basically mini power plants. Typically in the U.S., they can run up to 5 megawatts of power on their own, which is, you know, enough to power a small town or even a, you know, somewhat larger town. They're not the kind of things that you can, you know, fly in by helicopter, sit down, and hook up in a day. In fact, they're not the kind of things where there's big stockpiles of them available. They're usually manufactured to order. And the power requirements, I mean, they have brought in much smaller generators and batteries and different things to try to get power, and that's how they've been able to stave off disasters so far, but they're just not proven to be powerful enough to run the plant safety system. I mean, that's how they're pumping the seawater in, presumably. I mean, we can't think of any other way they could actually run pumps to bring the seawater in. But, you know, those kinds of much smaller backup systems that they brought in, they've just found are not enough to run their plant.
And Michael Marriott, reading from your information sheet that you continually update, you know, the fire at Unit 4 appears to have been in a fuel pool. Anything else of a breaking news story? I mean, you've said here that that fire is said to be extinguished, which would indicate to me that the fire being gone, the heat may be down, and perhaps that unit could be contained. I mean, are you going back and forth with just that kind of conversation in your head here before you make these posts?
Well, yeah, of course. You know, the fact that there was a fire is significant. That undoubtedly released some pretty serious radiation into the air. And like I said, we don't know actually how long the fire was in progress. It is actually encouraging that they were able to put it out. But this is, you know, the very clear fear is that this is the kind of thing we're going to be seeing because, you know, like the reactors, the fuel pools need water circulating constantly to keep them cool. When the water stops circulating and being replaced, what happens is that the heat from the fuel rods can begin boiling the water. And as everybody knows, with boiling water, eventually it all goes out through evaporation. And if you uncover these fuel rods, you know, fires can start, radiation will be released. And in fact, if they, you know, actually, because of melting or something, fall off of their racks, how they're racked, and touch each other, you can actually get a nuclear criticality. You know, it's a very serious problem.
Just explain what a nuclear criticality is.
Well, it's basically a chain reaction. You would get what happens inside the reactor core when a reactor is producing power, except it is not inside a reactor core. So the consequences of that, you're going to be getting extremely high levels of radiation and potential explosions.
And those explosions now would be emitting radioactive material openly, nothing to stop them, right?
Pretty much. We don't know the exact state of the fuel pools. The fuel pools in these reactors are located above the reactor core inside the sort of the outer containment building, which is the secondary containment. We know that at two of these reactors, that the top thirds of these buildings, these secondary containment buildings, have been blown off. The fuel pool sits directly below that top third. What we don't know is what the condition of the roof is above the fuel pools, or if there even is a roof above the fuel pools at this point. We don't know the extent of damage. Certainly the second explosion that struck Unit 3, I guess that was on, I don't even remember what day it was anymore, I'm getting lost, I think Sunday, was a larger explosion than the first one that occurred, and it looks like the damage to the building, at least from the photos we've seen, somewhat more extensive. So that definitely gives rise to concern about whether the fuel pools are, you know, even indoors at this point.
The time difference has really been difficult to follow this breaking story, and we've heard sometimes reports of explosions, you know, the morning after.
That's right. When it's day in the U.S., it's night in Japan, and vice versa. So,
and so here again, when we talk about explosions, we heard that in some ways, depending on what kind of explosion you're talking about, that that can relieve pressure and actually calm the plant. So in terms of what's in the containment pools from, and that's waste material, right? That's, well, it's recycled contaminants from the plant, but the storage pools themselves, the fact that they blew up, couldn't that mean, you know, a little bit less radiation at the site now? So maybe that would cool things?
I wouldn't rely on that.
Okay, I guess I shouldn't rely strictly on the industry's comments coming out of Japan at this time then. Okay. Michael Marriott, thank you so much. Is there anything else you'd like to add finally, especially about your group?
No, just that, you know, people, you know, we're trying to update people as well as we can. We have, you know, colleagues in Japan who have been, you know, basically staying up 24 hours a day, translating documents and materials and trying to keep us informed with what's going on there. And then we're trying to, you know, pass it along to our audience. And people can check the website or our Facebook pages for these updates as we are able to post them, which is, I have to admit, there's sometimes a delay, but we do our best.
And you're talking about the group that has the press conferences on in the evening. I saw one with an engineer. I believe he had worked for one of the plants in constructing, actually, the containment vessel for the core.
Right. That's the Citizens Nuclear Information Center. They're one key source of information. Green Action Kyoto is another key source of information, and there are a few other groups that we're acquainted with. We've been actually working quite closely with a number of groups in Japan over the past 2 months on a different nuclear issue, so we have pretty good ties with them.
And is anyone, that group or yours, any that you know of, calling on the U.S. government to do or say anything now? I mean, what would you hope to see in the next 24 hours from the White House or any other branch?
Well, I think from the White House, a retraction of their statement that nuclear energy is clean energy might be in order. The main thing that I would be looking for to the White House for right now is, I think, as I mentioned a bit earlier, I think it is time for the U.S. government to ensure that we have, you know, adequate radiation monitoring capability so that we will know when radioactive plumes reach North America and you know, how significant those plumes are, if in fact they're significant at all. They may well not be.
Michael Marriott, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Okay. Thank you.
The website is NIRS, NIRS.org. For Michael Marriott, he's the executive director at the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, and you can check the FDA webpage for information about potassium iodine. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Storrs, Connecticut. I'm your host and producer, Dori Smith. Today's show was co-produced by John Schwenk. Our website is talknationradio.org, and we'll have updates on Japan there. You can send us your news and information about Japan at talknationradio@gmail.com.